Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Available on demand starting November 12th is Noah Baumbach's Frances Ha, starring Greta Gerwig, and Blackfish.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The art house is now in your house.
This episode is also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code SVU1113.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, streaming video unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. And in this episode, we're going to seek escape from the harsh realities of our day-to-day lives by geeking out about movies in ways both amusing and terribly, terribly sad. And that's not even inspired by our main review of The Dirties. That's just business as usual here on the Film Spotting SVU podcast.
Yes, the advantage of this being an audio podcast, you can't see the tears streaming down our faces the whole time we record this. Yes, we are talking about The Dirties this week, a Canadian independent film that's currently in theaters and available to rent online, thanks to the support of one Kevin Smith. That'll be later in the show after our Q-Shot segment, in which we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered around a common theme. In honor of The Dirties, we were just going to unload about our complicated relationships with Kevin Smith as a filmmaker and pop culture figure over the years. But, you know, that's better saved for our therapists. And also, we wanted to avoid any potential battles with his devoted and sometimes pugnacious following. So instead, we're going to talk about found footage films. But before all of that, we have Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand on cable. So, Matt, what are our picks this week?
Our picks this week are a bunch of films I haven't seen yet, but all highly anticipated. These are three fall films that I am definitely interested in checking out. The first one is available on VOD starting on November 5th, and it's called Parkland, directed by Peter Landsman and produced by, among other people, Tom Hanks. It's an ensemble drama about the immediate aftermath of the JFK assassination. So you have all these actors playing different characters from around the assassination. You have Paul Giamatti, who's playing Abraham Zapruder, who shot the famous Zapruder film of the actual shooting. You have Zac Efron playing one of the doctors who tried to save JFK's life. I don't want to spoil how it turned out, so I'll leave it there. You have James Badgedale playing Lee Harvey Oswald's brother. I think Jackie Weaver plays his mother. You have Billy Bob Thornton as a Secret Service agent. And there's a few other interesting members of the cast as well. The movie played at Venice and Toronto, the film festivals, of course, not just like in those cities.
Good morning, everyone. This is Norwood McClendon reporting. Fort Worth temperature 56 degrees, Dallas 55.
Nice day for a motorcade.
President and Mrs. Kennedy arrived in Fort Worth from Houston late.
Anything you hit on the president's visit you don't like, tell the Secret Service. Their show.
The president scheduled two speeches.
We're going to be okay here.
Oh, yeah. It's a good program.
It will now only be a matter of minutes until the arrival.
Early lunch today. I want everybody downstairs to see the president.
Now they've turned on to Elm Street. Ah,
there he is!
Allison, I think you were just in Dallas at the Book Depository, right?
I was. I was there for another upcoming,
right,
there
a different
many,
project.
There are many upcoming JFK
it's
anniversary.
The 50th anniversary.
Yeah, exactly. That was for Killing Kennedy, which is the National Geographic film with Rob Lowe as JFK. And yeah, there's a lot going on around there. There's that weird grimness of being like, there's an X on the road where
he was shot.
They say he was shot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything while you were down there?
Probably too much. If you want me to go into intense detail,
give me
about
one.
That,
no, just one tidbit.
I think I knew almost nothing about Lee Harvey Oswald and the fact that he went to Russia for a while and tried to defect to Russia. He was a Marxist and but also just kind of disenchanted with, you know, life. He was kind of just an angry young man that, you know, I had no idea. So that was really interesting to me. And he brought back a Russian bride who didn't speak much English.
Oh, wow. I didn't know
and
that.
And he's still alive. And she lives in Texas.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, okay. See, now you're giving me a tidbit. That was a good tidbit.
Yeah.
If only Lee Harvey Oswald had had like a camera to film himself.
and could have left the footage somewhere to
right,
be discovered later.
Things could have turned out very differently for decades of conspiracy theories.
Certainly.
Oh, well, the film is called Parkland again, and it's available on VOD on November 5th. Two more recommendations for you. The first is available on November 8th, and it's called How I Live Now, directed by Kevin MacDonald, who's the filmmaker behind Last King of Scotland and the documentary about Bob Marley that was, I believe, just titled Marley. This is based on a young adult novel about a girl who's played in the film by Saoirse Ronan, who's a fabulous young actress. She's, like, sent to live with cousins in England, and while she's there, World War III essentially breaks out, and the movie is about her as she struggles to survive and this kind of, like, budding dystopia kind of a thing. I mean, in this case, I haven't read the book, and I don't know too much about it, but I'm really just going on Kevin MacDonald and Saoirse Ronan as a team that would be of interest to me. Allison, have you seen
it? I haven't
read the book.
No,
anything?
No, but it's a really interesting, crazy concept. Certainly,
yeah.
Seeing the trailer for this, it just
good
looked
trailer,
like, it, a good trailer, and also just a combination of elements that I wouldn't have expected.
Right, you don't see too often, like,
yeah,
this perspective on the kind of World War III style movie.
Right, like a teen romance perspective.
A teen romance.
Yeah, so it's an interesting combo.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah, me too. So that's How I Live Now, available on VOD on November 8th. And finally, also available on November 8th is a film called Ass Backwards, directed by Chris Nelson and written by and starring Casey Wilson and June Diane Raphael. And in this case, I'm recommending it primarily on the basis of those two names right there. They're comedy writing partners. You might know them from different things. Casey Wilson was on Saturday Night Live for a few years. She was on a show I haven't watched called Happy Endings.
Yeah,
have you watched that?
Yeah, she's very funny on that. It's
she was great on
canceled,
SNL.
Yeah.
It was canceled, right? Yeah. I was always bummed out that she was only on SNL for like 2 years. I thought she was really talented there. And June Diane Raphael has done a bunch of stuff. She's one of the co-hosts of the How Did This Get Made podcast, which I listen to and enjoy.
She's on Burning Love.
She's on Burning Love, which is like a parody of The Bachelor, which is cute, but to me, like, The Bachelor is the only best parody of The Bachelor you need.
Right,
so,
but you are a Bachelor devotee.
I am, and it sounds like we haven't mentioned this before, it sounds like you're kidding, but I am, actually.
Totally serious.
Totally serious. And there's no better mockery of The Bachelor than The Bachelor itself, so it's almost unnecessary. Nevertheless, I think they're really funny, really talented women, and so the fact that they star in it and also wrote it together makes me very interested. I'll just read very quickly a synopsis I have here. It says, lovable losers Kate and Chloe, which are Casey and June Diane, are best friends with a not-so-firm grip on reality. The girls have been inseparable ever since tying for dead last at a kiddie beauty pageant as children. Now they are all grown up and living in New York City, where Chloe is a rising star dancing in a glass box at a nightclub, rising star in quotation marks, and Kate is the, quotation marks, CEO of her own one-woman egg donor corporation. Excellent also supporting cast. Alicia Silverstone, John Cryer, Vincent D'Onofrio, Brian Garrity, Bob Odenkirk, and Paul Scheer all in this one as well. So I am officially intrigued. That is Ass Backwards, and that is available on VOD starting on November 8th.
We're very happy to have Shutterstock.com back as a sponsor of this episode of Film Spotting SVU. At Shutterstock.com, you can find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. You can choose from over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics, and they have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips, and many of its contributors are professional filmmakers. Shutterstock reviews each video individually for content and quality before adding it to its library, and Shutterstock adds 12,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you can find something new.
Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to take your creative projects to the next level, and they make it easy with sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. As you find the video assets you're looking for, you can save them to a clip box, and then you can access your selections anytime and share them with other team members. Shutterstock has flexible pricing, and you can choose between individual clips or video packs, and you can also download clips in HD or save them with standard definitions or web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just start your account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code SVU1113, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code SVU1113. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me. And I have no proxy. Oh, I always feel like somebody's watching me. Tell me, is it just a dream? When I come home, it's not.
All right, so our subject this week for Q Shots is found footage. We really had two obvious choices here. It was really bullying or found footage. But we just did Carrie, which is, you know, bullying. That's a really, and we talked a little bit about it, and it just seemed like that would be too repetitive of a subject. So we'll save bullying for another time, perhaps, when you've all forgotten that we reviewed Carrie in the first place, and we could talk about that one. So instead, we'll do found, did you leave this videotape here?
I have never seen it before.
It's got this funny, like an X on it, but doesn't have any other markings on it. Why would you leave this videotape here?
I don't know. We should put it in the player.
Let's put it in.
Let's find out what's on there.
It's us sitting here recording this podcast. Did you do this?
No. Where is the camera? How did someone even do this?
Oh my God! And scene.
And there we go. And we could shoot that for a very affordable
and probably
price.
Sell it to a small
distributor.
Indie distributor for millions of dollars.
Millions and millions.
If anyone's interested, please email SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. So found footage, Allison.
Yes.
Besides the fact that everyone is exactly like the scenario we just played right now.
Yes, that overused podcast horror genre.
Is there anything we want to say in a general sense about found footage movies?
Well, you know, it's very bound up with the horror genre just because it's a great way to do on the cheap horror, right? Like it limits your scope by having it, you know, you can do it on a consumer grade camera. That's fine because that would fit in with a story.
Right.
You can have it be from someone's restricted point of view because they're shooting the video.
Right.
So they don't need to see the ghost the whole time or whatever is trying to murder them.
Right.
You know, some of the most famous examples, right? The Blair Witch Project, you know, and Paranormal Activity. All of these have managed to do very thrifty, very lucrative, very successful, you know, the horror films out of this idea.
When you hear about stories of like the most financially successful or profitable like movies of all time, a lot of them are found footage horror movies that cost like $15,000 to make and caught on. They just, you know, someone picked them up and released them, and then they end up making $200 million. And when your movie only cost a couple of grand to make, that's, you know, it's like winning the lottery as movie making. It's a story that you hear quite a bit. I think the other thing that's important to note about why it's so good for low budget filmmaking is it excuses, hypothetically, you may not agree as a viewer, but hypothetically, it excuses all manner of bad filmmaking. You know, normally
it demands it almost.
It almost demands it. You're right. Any amount of like out of focus, blurriness, rack focus, shaky camera, bad sound, bad acting, almost any sin that would be committed, and particularly by like a small independent film, by, you know, young filmmakers who are working with, you know, inexperienced with the materials, with the equipment, maybe working with actors who are inexperienced. It just it pastes over all of that. It smooths it all over so that it's not really a problem. Hypothetically, we may think, well, in this case, it doesn't work, or in that case, it's still not believable. And I think something that I want to discuss later is that in some ways it actually makes it can make it tougher in some ways. In terms of like the suspension of disbelief, which I think is something that's very critical to this subgenre and needs to be discussed. But I think that's also a reason why you see it is because, you know, if I don't really have a great cinematographer, but I have a decent one, just have him, you know, it's okay if it's not perfect. In fact, as you said, it's almost demands to be imperfect in order to achieve that right look.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's interesting about this is as everyone becomes an amateur cinematographer with just their phone, even, we're seeing some more kind of interesting ways in which this genre is used, subgenres used. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned King Kelly before, which is a really interesting film about self-documentation.
Yes.
And just kind of the narcissism inherent in that, needing to constantly kind of be posing for your own selfie.
Right.
But we've also seen found footage, as much as it's common in low-budget films, in some bigger-budget ones, one of which I'm going to talk about. But, you know, something like Chronicle, which is unfortunately not streaming, which is a film I know I liked a lot, and you did too,
yeah.
I remember.
Very good.
That made really interesting and large-scale use of found footage, and, you know, touches on some of the same subject matter as The Dirties, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah. But you mentioned King Kelly. That is available on Netflix to stream. Not one of our picks, but yeah, it's not a horror movie, but it uses all those tropes in a really interesting way. And yeah, it definitely reflects not just found footage and filming things, but also this sort of like age of selfies and Facebook. And, you know, like the movie actually interacts with its own Facebook page within the world of the movie, where the characters are uploading things they're doing and shooting to Facebook. And then characters are commenting on them in the movie, and then it like escalates the movie in a way, which I think is really smart. There's two general questions I briefly want to get answered before we move to our picks. And
okay.
Number one is the most important, which is, how do we separate found footage from mockumentary or fake documentary?
Right.
How do we do that?
I don't know that there's a clear line. Some films obviously start off with this tape was found, the footage was not altered or whatever,
right,
to tell
right.
you, you know, this was literally found somewhere in
right.
the universe of the film. I think other times it's less clear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Paranormal Activity. You've raised this question before. If this is found footage, who has edited it together?
Right.
You know, and also, why did they not just cut right to the dramatic, scary moments as opposed to letting it build slowly for an hour and a half?
Right.
You know, is the demon editing it?
That was my suggestion, actually, for Paranormal Activity 2,
mm-hmm.
which was the first one. I think is actually a pretty tight, you know, experience, fairly, relatively speaking, if you buy into the concept of this couple filming themselves, sticking the camera at one end of the room, and like you see the footage kind of flying by because they're just filming all night long. Paranormal Activity 2 is like security cameras, and they're like cutting back and forth, and they're not cutting back and forth for like maximum, like to show you things. They're cutting back and forth for like maximum like suspense and scares. Like, they're not showing you what's happening. They're showing you almost like what's not happening and people reacting as things out of sight happen. So yeah, it almost felt to me like an evil demon or something was cutting, like a spirit was cutting it just to mess with people. But that is that's sort of the other question, which we'll have to get to too, is, do you care personally, Allison, if how closely a found footage movie follows the rules of, this is a found object? Like, you know, do you care if it's a quote-unquote found object and it's clearly cut together and multiple angles and very much obviously not a, you know, it doesn't have a guise of documentary? Does it bother you?
It doesn't bother me, though there are definitely times in the more, certainly horror, where I get irritated with, why is this person still filming?
Yeah.
Or when it doesn't make it any better when they raise the question within the movie, which I think happens in The Diary of the Dead, the Romero film that's mm-hmm. the found footage film. Oh, I think at one point someone's like, you know, explaining why they're still filming. And you're like, shut up. Like, I don't want to hear your, you know, kind of moody explanation for
yeah.
this documenting this. Like, if it's intrusive, either because you can't help thinking about it or because it needs to engage a discussion too much, I think that's a problem.
It's funny that the issue of why are they still filming is the one that you point to as the one that bugs you. And I actually almost never have that problem. I almost think that society and Facebook and movies like King Kelly pointing it out, like, society's almost explained why they're still filming at this point, because people are filming everything at all times now. Somebody put up a video on Facebook I was watching earlier today of a traffic accident. I was just like, why would anyone film this? But somebody did. Somebody is always filming. You know what I mean? So to a certain extent, society's like insanity has almost validated some of these more outrageous and unbelievable horror movies.
Yeah, and I agree now. I think that is something that maybe now has become plausible, especially
maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy,
right? If in the age of like the camera phone, but
yeah.
maybe, and that brings us to it's a good transition to my first pick, which is, you know, one of the big the obvious found footage, like big budget film that you would think of. It's available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, YouTube, and Sony, which would be Cloverfield.
Mm.
And this film was a 2008 film. And I remember at the time that that issue came up for me because it's someone recording on a camcorder, right? And
yes.
At a certain point, you're like, you are running for your life.
Running for your life.
From a monster.
But keeping the monster kind of in frame.
Sort of in frame. Yeah. Like artfully kind of like just behind to save via, you know, VFX shots.
Yeah.
It's a very effective film. And to see the aesthetics of found footage be put together with high-end special effects does work incredibly well. I think that juxtaposition, you know, at least in terms of how those effects suddenly look on screen, it still has a lot of impact. And I think as we're even as we've become like more used to seeing that kind of like shaky cam combined with special effects, you know, it does make you re-examine the monster, you know, looming in the background in a different way than you would if you was shot like a more traditional movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the interesting things about Chronicle, which, you know, was directed by Matt Reeves, written by Drew Goddard, and J.J. Abrams was the producer and was kind of kept secret, stars a group of actors, some of whom are more famous now. Most at the time were relatively unknown. But I think one of the things that's interesting about it being a found footage movie and also a disaster movie is that it kind of can't help but recall 9/11 just because of that's what happens when you have kind of documentary style footage, right?
Yeah.
Especially it's a film that starts in downtown New York, and the initial shot of them going out into the street and seeing buildings collapsing at the end is like, it looks like, you know, a lot of the footage that was shot that day. I don't say that as a condemnation or praise necessarily, just that it's one of those consequences of reframing the way you look at a disaster footage, so it doesn't look like a blockbuster necessarily, but
right,
it's supposed to look real. And it was one of those things that was definitely on my mind when I saw it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I think now we've just had a whole summer of, you know, blockbusters about buildings falling down. It doesn't
Man of Steel, Star Trek
exactly.
Into Darkness.
It doesn't necessarily feel the same way, or obviously
right,
we're over that bump. But I feel like this was the first film to really, the first big commercial film that was not explicitly, you know, about that kind of engaged that imagery.
You mentioned also the found footage aspect, I think, is absolutely part of the reason it makes you think of 9/11. And maybe it's one of the reasons these movies have become more prevalent and popular in the wake of 9/11 is they do explicitly or implicitly evoke that horror, and like the way that we all saw that horror, which was through camera phones and like, you know, low grade video. It immediately recalls that. It makes you think of it, and it just makes it that much more immediate and intense and terrifying.
Yeah, and I think it says something to how well that works, that the fact that this is a film populated by characters, I think it's very difficult to latch onto at all. You know, it's based around, I think, one of the most annoying, you know, like, I need to go, let us travel through this city that is being destroyed so that I can find the girl that I'm in love with.
Don't they
with,
like walk through the entire like
the
underground
subway yes,
tunnel?
And someone gets, you know, hurt and they get attacked and like, you just like
there's some problems there.
Yeah, there are some problems, definitely. But despite that, it works incredibly well. It's so kind of lean once the monster shows up and just how, you know, how those scenarios are played out. It's so clever.
Mm.
It's a very smart take on that monster movie that I think in engaging the naturally limited viewpoint that comes with found footage, you know, you're just people on the street. All the information you have comes from the news that you can find, right? There's no larger explanation about where the monster came from, like what is making it attack, like what's happening, what's going on. Well, it's only from their viewpoint. It makes the scale more impressive, you know, because you don't see the whole thing.
Mm.
What was that noise?
It sounded like an animal.
Phone calls are pouring into the New York One newsroom as a thunderous roaring sound.
Do you even see something on the roof?
What animal sounds like that? It's shaking everywhere, man. It's like tremors.
Looks like you should have left town a little bit earlier.
It was, you know, a minor landmark in that way. It was a very worthwhile way of refreshing a kind of old-fashioned, certainly old-fashioned, you know, monsters attacking a city, a giant monster attacking the city, that idea. So that is Cloverfield, and it is available to rent on all of the usual suspects.
You know, just thinking about it, and you talking about 9/11, and I'm wondering if one of the other things that is connected between 9/11 and the found footage thing, just an example of Cloverfield is, it's allowed to have, and I don't want to spoil it, but like kind of an unhappy bummer of an ending.
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of like mainstream movies and bigger movies, you know, they're about like heroes. And found footage movies are often just about average people who are caught in these extraordinary circumstances.
Often. Yeah.
Exactly. They're about victims. And they're allowed to have sort of like sad endings and depressing endings that not just reflect, you know, tragedy, any of the real world tragedies, but are just, I don't know, sometimes more satisfying in a way that a lot of mainstream Hollywood movies avoid, you know?
Yeah, because it's not about the person who like you know, powers through and gets to live on to tell a tale.
Right. It's not about the guy who killed, you know, the scientist who figured out the way to kill the monster.
It's the about people who we see in other movies kind of being, you know, fodder on the side, who get caught and don't get to go,
which
on.
Is just, you know, so much more relatable as a viewer, and it does call to mind some real world events. So yeah, I'm just like piecing this all out as you're talking about it, and I think that's another reason why that movie and a lot of these movies, these found footage movies, which have similar kind of bummer endings, I think are really effective. Anyway, that's a good pick. I agree. There's some problems with some of the story, and yeah, you're right. He probably would put that camera down at some point, but certainly an effective film. My first pick, I'm going to just do this one first, even though it's my streaming pick. It's available just recently on Netflix, and it is VHS 2. It's directed by a whole fleet of filmmakers, including Simon Barrett, Adam Wingard, Eduardo Sanchez, Greg Hale, Timo Taranto, Gareth Hugh Evans, and Jason Eisner. It's a sequel to the 2012 found footage movie VHS. The premise of both is basically the same. People kind of unwittingly come upon sort of the thing we were joking at the top of the show. They like find VHS tapes that are, you know, not marked. They put them in, and they discover on these VHS tapes these strange events. And it's an anthology film where you watch all these different shorts. They are the shorts in the film are the shorts on the tapes. Frankly, the concept, like the framing concept, does not work, I don't think, in either case. I think they're kind of silly, particularly because it's not like these shorts. Are like VHS shorts. They don't look like they're on VHS. They're not set in the 1980s. They're all modern. They're done, especially in the new movie, with like GoPro cameras, really high-end prosumer equipment, you know, really rugged run-and-gun kind of HD stuff that can get knocked around. You can like stick it on your head and kind of run around, and the camera will film it all like that. It doesn't really make any sense that they would be on VHS tapes.
Yeah, it was one of the things I actually appreciated about Paranormal Activity 3. Is that it has, you know, cruddier technology that's kind of included a bit. You know, one of the main shots is a camcorder taped to an oscillating fan.
Right, they got great use out of that in that film.
Yeah, where you're like, you're not pretending. It's, you can stick a camera, you know, to your head with easily.
Yeah, and so I think you kind of have to overlook the overarching concept here, but I think that's fairly easy to do because I actually find that in both cases, the shorts are generally pretty fun, and I like, In this case, there's four shorts, and I liked three out of the four of them in VHS 2 quite a bit. My favorite of the bunch is this one called Slumber Party Alien Abduction, which is as described. This is the one that's by Jason Eisner, who directed Hobo with a Shotgun. I just said it like I was really Jewish. Hobo with a Shotgun. Hobo with a Shotgun, which I was not a huge fan of that film, but I think he did a great job with this. It starts off, it's almost like, you know, it evokes kind of like the Goonies or something like with, you know, kids. It's about a bunch of kids at a slumber party. They're sort of like pranking and pestering the older teenagers who are watching them. And then all of a sudden, aliens appear, and it's basically just nonstop insanity after that, just totally, like, pure terrifying mayhem. And I just found it really, really effective. You know, Hobo with a Shotgun was so winking and kind of nudge-nudge, you know, poking you in the ribs with, look at how clever I am. And there's nothing winking or kind of cutesy about this. This is just, like, you know, the ultimate experience in grueling terror, to steal an old-fashioned horror tagline. It's really good. I also really liked Phase 1 Clinical Trials, directed by Adam Wingard, which is like Adam Wingard is the guy who did You're Next. He's also the star of this one. And the idea is that he's one of his eyes has been like damaged somehow. Oh, Allison's cringing. Body horror. Here we go. He has his eye replaced with like a robo camera or something. But it's basically like it's haunted. He sees ghosts through the robo camera or whatever in his eye, and he can't take it out.
Ah, it's like the eye.
It is like the eye. So yeah, it's pretty creepy. Very well executed. It's a clever premise.
You can't see anything out of your biological eye?
No.
Okay. How about now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little better. It's just kind of blurry and shadowy.
Yeah. All right. Well, because your prosthesis is attached directly to your visual cortex, you realize essentially battling with your camera eye to give you input right now. So when your brain gets used to having that chip in there, you should start to see more and more out of your uninjured eye again. Until then, you might see some glitches.
What do you mean by glitches?
Well, this is just being tested now. Eye injuries like yours are quite rare. So that's why we've installed a recording chip into the eye itself so we can test the data that it's receiving.
Right, yeah. About that.
Yes?
Oh, my God. So if I want private time, what do I do? How do I turn this off?
Well, you can't. But that's just for this trial period. I mean, you can't expect the KPG Corporation to just give you this implant and not expect to test its data.
I also really liked A Ride in the Park, which is one producer and one director of the Blair Witch Project actually doing another found footage movie. It's a zombie short. I don't know if I want... I'll just say that the main character is a zombie.
Okay, interesting.
With a camera on him. Okay. So it's kind of a fun twist on familiar territory. But I think, you know, we talked already about what makes something found footage, what makes something a documentary, and putting down the camera. And I think the advantage of these shorts are you don't have to suspend your disbelief for 90 minutes or 100 minutes. It's a lot easier to buy these premises when they're sort of like in the short term, when they're just like 15, 20 minutes or sometimes even less, just a quick hit. It just makes more sense, you know, so it's a lot easier to kind of digest. And they really take some fun chances with the technology, with the GoPros, those cameras. They really do some crazy shots, and it's very inventive. And like I said, while the overarching premise doesn't make a lot of sense, and probably even within each short, the reality might break down if you think too hard about it, I think there's some really fun horror filmmaking going on here. So that's VHS 2, and it's available now on Netflix.
All right. Well, my streaming pick is a film called Troll Hunter, which is available for streaming on Netflix and on Amazon Instant Video. And it's not really a horror film. It's more, it's kind of a fantasy film. It's like a contemporary fantasy film. It's a Norwegian film from 2010, directed by Andre Overdahl. And it is about three college students who set out to make what they think is going to be a Michael Moore-style confrontational documentary about a man they believe is a bear poacher.
Right.
Only to find out that he's actually Norway's only state-employed troll hunter. And he kind of goes out and hunts down trolls that are causing trouble. Only ones that are venturing out of their territory and attacking German tourists and, you know, causing problems. But generally otherwise, trolls stay where they are, and they're kept secret by the government. So these college students feel like they've really discovered a great thing, and they're going to do this expose. And I think what makes this work well, other than what it kind of spoke about before, which is that combination of kind of shaky documentary style footage with special effects that is kind of the juxtaposition is still very interesting, is that it's based around the character Hans, played by Otto Jespersen, who is the troll hunter, who is this really, he's so unruffled all the time, even in the face of hunting down giant trolls. And he's also disgruntled. Like, he is this poor government employee who drives around in a beat up camper and works bad hours. And the reason that he lets these filmmakers follow him is that he kind of wants them to expose this world, in part because he feels like
he's pissed off.
He's not getting treated well. And also he's kind of upset about the way the trolls are being treated. There's actually a strange melancholy to the whole idea. As much as the trolls are not made cute, they are giant, lumbering, smelly, farting, goat-eating animals. They're incredibly dumb. He, you know, doesn't like having to kill them all the time. And that's part of the reason he offers this expose. But it's a slow build, deliberately. Kind of, you know, it starts off with the slow discovery of one type of troll and kind of builds up to exposing different types of trolls and also troll mythology. Mm-hmm. It's very clever. Like, it's a very fun film that makes a lot from what feels like fairly little that they, you know, had to work with. It's not a, our $100 million blockbuster, but they managed to offer this kind of both like scope and this commentary on government bureaucracy and kind of secrecy. One of the antagonists, if you want to call it that, is someone who's in charge of the, you know, Department of Trolls in the government, who is working to keep trolls secrets. Mm. No matter what.
Was er vårt total?
Hold kjeft nå.
Skal jeg gjøre noe, eller?
Det ligger sånne kompress i førstehjelpsskrinet bak deg.
Ah, faen. Ikke.
Ja, vi må løfte det for deg.
Så du ser ut av det.
But it's, you know, filmed out in rural Norway in really gorgeous looking, like very remote areas. And they managed to make the concept, run with the concept in very smart ways. And it's funny and it's a smart little film. It's Troll Hunter. It is available for streaming on Netflix and on Amazon Instant Video.
So you're very drawn to the found footage movies that are specifically about giant things. People
Apparently,
recording giant things.
Yeah, I wanted to steer away from the more traditional horror in that. So I kind of ended up with some
focused
monsters,
on the giant monsters.
With giant monsters,
well,
yeah.
But again, that speaks to sort of what we were already saying. That's an interesting perspective on big things because, you know, it gives us what it would feel like to a human being. You know, so many like Godzilla movies, and I love Godzilla movies, but you know, it's guys in a suit fighting
or in the plane, but
you don't get the sense of scale and scope. You know, they feel like people in rubber suits. They don't feel like giants. You know, everything just seems normal sized instead of big. And when you have these movies like the Cloverfield monster and the trolls, like they have a sense of grandeur to them,
right,
and bigness that you don't necessarily get because the camera is so low to the ground. Like, that helps create that sense of scale.
Exactly. You're seeing from the perspective of people who are running away,
right?
Or like being, you know, chased by this giant thing.
And again, the metaphor of just like, you know, like ordinary tiny people being caught in enormous circumstances. I mean, it literalizes that because these creatures are so big that humanity seems so dwarfed by the creatures. Yeah. Good picks all around. Okay, my last pick is available on Amazon and iTunes to rent. And if you're a Hulu Plus subscriber, the Criterion Collection has it streaming on there as well. It's called Man Bites Dog. It's directed by three gentlemen whose names are going to be mispronounced by me right now. Remy Belveau, André Bonzel, and Benoit Poulbord. I apologize to all three of them, because I butchered all of their names, and they made such a fabulous film. The least I could do was do better, but oh well. Actually, this film, which I think you've seen, Allison,
mm-hmm,
is kind of similar to The Dirties in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's about a documentary film crew that is following around a serial killer, making a movie about him, and at first they're just sort of recording his crimes, but as the movie goes on, they become sort of increasingly complicit in his actions. And I don't want to compare the two too much because I don't want to spoil our review of The Dirties, which is coming up in just a few minutes. But they are very similar, right down to the sort of senses of humor, the very dark humor about, you know, these killers or these very deranged people who are the subjects of the films. The thing that's kind of the big difference to my mind between the two and what makes Man Bites Dog particularly interesting is that the filmmakers are really actively part of the film we're watching. They're not unseen observers who are filming this guy. They become increasingly involved in these horrible things he's doing, and they're characters in the film. And eventually we're watching them as much as we are watching the killer.
Patrick, notre preneur de son, est mort. Ce sont des choses qui ne sont pas faciles à dire, et je vais peut-être le dire platement, mais...
You know, it's not a case, because we've talked about this, of, you know, like, who found this footage? Who are the people making it? What was their point of view? The movie makes all that quite clear. I mean, we might not know ultimately who edited the film or is presenting it to us, but it's very clear who made it. And so I think it's very interesting to watch the decisions of the filmmakers. And it just creates all these questions in your mind about not just this extreme example, but all documentary filmmakers and why they film what they film and how they don't become involved in some cases. You know, it kind of presages in a lot of ways reality television, this world where we're watching people do horrible things and nobody steps out from behind the camera to stop them. We all want to see them do these horrible things, you know, and people on these reality shows break into a fight, you know, or they, you know, almost kill someone potentially. No one puts down the camera to stop. Everyone keeps filming. You know, that's what we're all here to see. That's what they're here to film, and that's what we're here to watch. One last thing I would give it credit for is it does a very good job of maintaining the illusion of it being a fake documentary. You know, there's a lot of found footage movies. The one that immediately comes to mind for me is like End of Watch, which was a satisfying cop movie and a terrible found footage movie.
Yeah.
Because it has, you know, they established from the first scene that the cops, they're, you know, like, oh, we're going to wear button cameras and I've got a camera here. I'm doing a film for my film class.
That you will never see
that you'll
or
never
hear
see.
About really again.
Right. And that's why we have cameras. But then instantly there's
impossible
six, eight
shots,
camera
yeah.
shots. Yeah. Angles that are impossible. And it's just like, if that to me is like the worst you could do. If you're going to create this environment and these rules, you have to follow them. Either obey the rules or don't mention the rules. You know what I mean? And Man Bites Dog really generally does a really good job of keeping a believable, plausible reality to the fiction. That these are just like a couple of guys who are filming this. There's not a lot of angles that are impossible. It feels like a real documentary, which is what makes it so disturbing and effective.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this one. It's a really good film, and also one that just engages with the idea that you're not that just because you're like filming something, it doesn't excuse you really from,
right.
you know,
you're not
like,
inoculated from being
right because you're documenting something
right.
that you're not. Yeah. You have no responsibility towards what's being there. And also just about like falling in love with your subject because they're
yes.
such a good subject.
Right. And he is
a fantastic subject. Yeah. But
killer like, Ben is just so fascinating and charming. And
yeah.
That you do kind of fall in love with him even as he's just a
right.
horrific
you're like, oh,
person.
He's getting good stuff here, and even though good stuff is not necessarily good,
right?
You know.
Right, exactly. That there's a price that's paid, even if people don't want to address it. Yeah, so it's a really interesting movie, Man Bites Dog, available on Amazon and iTunes to rent, or you can stream it on Hulu Plus. Before we get to our listener's choice review, I've been putting out the call on Twitter at FilmspottingSVU for people to share their picks. For each week's cue shots, so I put the call out there. We've got some excellent recommendations we haven't mentioned yet. I've actually never seen either of these movies, so I'm wondering if you have, Allison, but let's get to them real quick. First up, we have Carl from Washington, D.C., and he wants to recommend Lake Mungo. He says it appears at first to be little more than a Paranormal Activity knockoff. After a young girl mysteriously dies, her family begins to experience unexplained phenomena which are caught on tape. First-time writer-director Joel Anderson presents the film as a faux documentary, allowing the audience to view news reports and talking heads, deftly establishing an apparently factual narrative, but it's not long before all these supposedly established truths are carefully laid to waste. By the time the credits roll, and you need to stick around for the credits, Carl says, we're left to ponder a rather unsettling question. What's more frightening, not knowing what lurks in the shadows or not knowing what lurks in the minds of the people we think we know best? So that's Lake Mungo. I haven't seen that one, Allison. Have you?
Yeah, I have seen it. It was actually one that I was considering for one of my picks, but then it felt like maybe it fell a little more in that fake documentary
There's
category.
No giant monsters in that one?
There's no giant... Yeah, it was also just appallingly short on giant monsters. I can't believe it. Like most movies, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought maybe it was like a little more of the mockumentary, if you want to use that word. But it is definitely... It's definitely a film that... has a lot of interesting twists that every time you think you know the direction it's going in, it jerks you back in a completely different one in a way that I really liked. So yeah, I would second that. That's
okay.
Definitely a film worth checking out.
All right, so that's Lake Mungo from Carl in Washington, D.C. And finally, we have one from Mark Freeman. He says, by no means the best, but at least one of the more effective found footage films is The Poughkeepsie Tapes, directed by John Dowdle. It has sequences that fall flat, but it has a grubby aesthetic and some effectively horrifying sequences. The footage of the woman bouncing on the balloon while a voice screams from behind the camera, "Pop it," is completely terrifying. I'm terrified just reading that description. Does the film hold together? Probably not, but it does use the found footage elements in an interesting way. Have you seen the Poughkeepsie tapes, Allison?
I haven't. It's not easy to see. This is a film, I'm not sure if it's it ever got an official release, but it's one that's kind of developed a following, certainly, and it's one I've heard a lot about.
Yeah, so, I have too.
Yeah, I have not seen it, but I'd be interested, certainly. All right.
Well, thank you for that recommendation, Mark, the Poughkeepsie tapes. And again, follow us on Twitter at FilmSpottingSVU, and whenever we decide what the subject of the theme of Q Shots is going to be, we put it up there, and we love to hear people's recommendations. Movies we haven't seen.
Yeah.
We got two more we haven't seen, so that's great.
Yeah,
that's exactly what we want to do.
I want to do a few quick mentions from Twitter. A few people wrote in.
Yes.
I'm not going to read everyone's username, but just some of the ones that were suggested. Someone says Blair Witch is far and away the best. Someone else suggests Bobcat Goldthwait's new found footage Bigfoot movie, Willow Creek, which is, I think, still on the festival circuit. I don't think it's
I haven't seen that. I didn't even know he made a found footage
movie. He kind of very
movie.
Quietly released it on the festival circuit. And I don't think he's got a distributor yet. But yeah, it's been slowly making the rounds.
Oh, that sounds intriguing.
So that's one. Someone else mentions Chronicle. Someone says, I really enjoyed The Last Broadcast. It predates Blair Witch.
Yeah.
It's very scary. Another person mentions The Bay. Yeah.
Barry Levinson,
a recent film.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Sort of like Jaws as found footage.
Yeah.
Not great, but it definitely has some really good moments.
Yeah, and someone else mentions Grave Encounters. So there we go.
Lots
some more suggestions
we
there.
Nobody's mentioned the other one that we got to, at least I got to throw in here, because somebody is going to be upset, and they should be because it's awesome, is Wreck.
Yes, it is.
It's one of the best.
Really
maybe
scary.
It might be the best found footage horror movie. The first one is really good.
It's so frightening.
It's really terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sequel's not as good. The first Wreck, which they remade in, I think, what was it?
Quarantine
was the American version.
Yep.
This is the original Spanish version. Wreck, REC. Oh my God, is really scary. It's up there with Blair Witch, I think, as...
Oh, yeah. It uses just the idea of how limited your perspective is just in the frame really well.
And it, again, has a very believable fake documentary aesthetic. You know, it really keeps to that one camera. It's like a crew that's accompanying a firefighting crew on like what their nightly, you know, rounds are like, and they just happen to catch the worst night of their lives. And very well done from a technical perspective. Really terrifying. Have we mentioned the other one? We got to mention Cannibal Holocaust. Have we mentioned it at all?
I don't think we have. But yeah,
we couldn't find it online anywhere.
Yeah, and that is, as far as I know, the first one. I would love to hear if there's one earlier in either the horror genre or otherwise.
It's definitely considered the granddaddy.
Yes, and actually
poobah
got the. You know, got the director in trouble a bit, right?
That's
he had
right.
to explain himself.
Right. People accused him of making a snuff film.
He had to produce the actors and be like, they're still alive.
Now, that's an effective fake found footage movie. If people think you actually murdered the actors, you've done a pretty good job.
What we should have done is just actually shot those guys. If we'd actually just gone and killed all the dirties. Can you imagine if we showed that movie to class? Oh, my God.
What, a movie of everybody dead?
No. If we just went and shot, what did Muldoon say? You can't make a school shooting movie? If we made a movie where we went in and we just shot the bad guys.
Yeah, that's what we did in our movie.
But if we actually did it, if we actually went with real guns and actually killed only the bad guys, but we just blew them away, all on camera, Muldoon's like, you know, guys, this is really, you didn't listen to me. I said it was too dark before when you were pretending to kill these guys. Now you actually kill them? Oh, you're actually going to kill these guys. Oh, that's funny.
Well, now it's time for our listener's choice section, in which we give you, the Film Spotting SVU listeners, an opportunity to vote on which film, or occasionally TV series, we review in the next podcast. And just a reminder, we're trying out something new for the next episode, which we'll explain in more detail in a little bit. But your choices this round were all recent films, Blue Caprice, The Dirties, and Haunter. And after a close race between those first two entries, The Dirties pulled out ahead. The Dirties, which is available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, Vudu, and Sony, is the directorial debut of Canadian filmmaker Matt Johnson, who also co-wrote and stars in the film as Matt, who, with his best friend Owen, played by Owen Williams, has been working on a goofy genre film for class in which the two of them take out the guys who've been bullying them, who they call The Dirties. This film is a genuine indie that premiered at Slamdance in January and came out in theaters earlier this month, courtesy of Kevin Smith, who calls it the most important film you will see all year. It has a $10,000 budget and is heavily improvised and takes the format of a found footage film that opens with a disclaimer about how the footage hasn't been altered. So Matt and Owen are geeks. They're film buffs, especially Matt, who copes with getting shoved
you
around.
Keep saying Matt is a film buff. Matt, I'm like, it's confusing.
It's not you.
Me.
It's not you.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But Matt, who copes with getting shoved around and humiliated by bullies, they both in different ways. You know, Owen, the quieter one, just deals with it, even braves talking to one of the popular girls he's had a crush on for years, and it doesn't go poorly. But Matt is goofy and always playing things off as a joke until we start to realize he's actually handling the bullying much worse. Especially as his proposed plan of shooting a sequel to the film in which he does actually kill the dirties start to seem less like a laugh as the laugh he initially presents it as. So, Matt, my first question to you is one that we've brought up before in this podcast. What did you think about how the film handled who's handling the camera here?
Oh, yeah, that is a big question. That was something I wrestled with personally. Yes, there's, I think, at least two cameramen involved. But the thing is, the movie never really addresses them. They are sort of silent witnesses. As I alluded to and when we were talking about Man Bites Dog, there's a film where the camera crew, who is making this, is made very clear. And while their actions are, we might question them and their, you know, their complicitness in these horrible things that are happening, at least we can like look at them. We can consider them. They're characters. And here, they are absences. And you might argue that that's a deliberate choice on the part of the director. I'm sure he would say it was, and I'm sure he had a reason for it. But that was something that did kind of frustrate me because, yeah, these cameramen are everywhere. They have, you know, great shots of everything that's going on. They're filming during classes, and it just seemed like a lot of times they really took me out of the quote-unquote reality of the film, was specifically sort of the magicalness of the camera crew, the fact that they don't, I think we hear one of their names at one point because
Jared, which is the name of the cinematographer. Jared Robb is the movie cinematographer.
I see. Yeah. I mean, Matt, the main character, the main actor, who's also the writer director. I mean, he does address him by name at one point. There's a couple of times where he talks directly to the camera, but there is this thing where they never get involved in anything that's happening. And again, I'm sure, from the director's perspective, this is a deliberate choice. He's saying that, you know, we've become so focused on our phones, our cameras, or what have you, that we now mediate our reality through them, that we're so focused on what we're looking at in front of us on a screen, that we don't see the danger in front of us, or we're not interacting with the world. But I have to say, there came several points where I was a little frustrated with it. I don't know about you.
Yeah, you know, I think there's an interesting theory I was reading from someone that I don't think is necessarily supported by the movie, but I can understand why they came up with it, which is that there's no camera and that this is just representing his kind of slipping reality, essentially.
Sure.
You know, that he, like the movie that he sets out, the sequel that he sets out to make, kind of the Dirties, the second Dirties that he wants to make.
Right.
That's the movie we're watching, right?
Yes.
Like we are, he is starring in his own movie.
Yeah.
And that I can see it in a certain way to be like,
there's a little bit of evidence in the movie, especially like the end credits. Like,
right. And I don't know that Owen ever acknowledges the camera. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't go through and look at it again to take note,
right.
But it's certainly Matt who addresses the camera all the time.
Yes.
And he's the main character and he's driving this action.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that we really get to see Owen by himself that much, you know?
No.
So you could argue it. I don't know that it's necessarily there, but I can understand why the theory was brought up, because there does seem to be this almost, this slippery reality
right.
to it, where
like,
either
magical,
you accept.
Magical, I think was the word
right,
I used.
Exactly. Like either you accept that these that filmmakers or someone, maybe a friend, has been following these guys for a really long time, you know, or like for no with
right.
no explanation,
and also never speaks, never comes out from like we never see the other camera on camera,
right? No one else acknowledges the camera,
right.
So yeah, there is like a magical aspect to it.
Yeah,
certainly.
The problem with that theory, although it's interesting,
yeah,
is the movie opens with a disclaimer saying this footage was discovered; it has not been altered in any way out of respect for the victims.
Right, and not just that. we watch them when they make The Dirty is the movie they're making for class. It's shot by someone.
Right.
We see them digging those shots.
Right.
You know, someone has holding the camera.
There's
at that
problems
point.
With the theory, in other
right.
words.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can understand why it was brought up. I don't know that it's necessarily a very central question, you know, but it's something you think about constantly in the film.
Right. But again, it's that thing to me where it's like what I was saying with End of Watch. It's like if you bring up. If you really address the conventions of it, if you have a disclaimer saying this is found footage, this is what it is, you know, to me that makes it more important to obey the rules. Maybe that's just my problem. I have a very literal mind. But like to me, it's like when you bring it up, that's when I start to focus on it. And I did find myself focusing on it a lot in this movie. I mean, I don't know about you, but that was something that I did get hung up on a little bit.
I don't know. It wasn't something, I think it bothered you more than it bothered me, but
right.
it is this kind of question mark that's left there hanging over the whole film.
Right.
What did you think of its portrayal of someone kind of contemplating violence, mass violence?
This movie was really interesting, and I also had some problems with it, to
yeah.
be totally honest. I mean, the ideas behind it, I think, are very interesting, and the conceit of a found footage movie about, you know, like a school shooter, I think, is a really smart one. But I don't know if I necessarily found the character Matt all that believable as a person, as someone who would go on a school shooting, as a high schooler. I mean, the actor seems to me like my age. He looks old to be a high schooler. Like it's interesting because the movie was shot in a real high school and a lot of the extras are real high school kids, and it adds a great flavor to the movie. And there are shots near the end of the movie that are like GoPros that have been set up all around the school, and it's just shots of kids walking down the hallways, and the kids in those shots look at least 10 years younger than our main actor. And so immediately that sort of put me off. And you know, it's this kind of thing where I was thinking about this, that found footage movies, they like can lower the bar for suspension of disbelief, but they can also like heighten our BS detector, because you're making some sort of claim to reality. You are saying this is a documentary, this is real, this is real things happening. So it doesn't have that veneer of fiction where you could say, well, this is a fiction, this is, you know, this is not real, it has its own rules. Hypothetically, we're looking at reality, and hypothetically, these events happened. And so it, you know, when things don't quite fit or make sense, it almost heightens that as a problem. And that's sometimes that's kind of what happened to me in this case, is that the character, he didn't really look quite right. He didn't really sound quite right to me. He just seemed like an assemblage of points, you know, about not just bullying and not just school shooting, but also mass media and being obsessed with, you know, filming and want, you know, like he's obsessed with movies and he quotes from movies. It just seemed like a combination of all these ideas, which are all independently very interesting. And I think the movie has interesting things to say about them. But as a collective whole, I don't know if it all holds together.
Yeah, I feel like I really liked character, like the portrait of the character and the particular way he starts to fall apart, because that actually was not one that I feel was portrayed much, and actually it was one that seemed very like just spoke to types of people I knew in middle school and high school, which is that the way that you kind of laugh about these things that are actually really bothering you, you know, that to smooth them over, you goof about them and you're like, haha, like the scenes in which they're bullied, which are cut throughout the film and are just kind of presented in this very without comment way, right? Like you see them in the halls just getting like thrown on the ground or like humiliated.
Yeah.
And it's just the day-to-day bullying that you might deal with, you know, in a really traditional way, like
yeah.
someone just, or like harassing you in the cafeteria or something. I thought those were presented like very well. And I thought that his reaction to them, Matt's in particular, where you just, or both of them actually, Owens, where you just,
those were
stoically
effective yeah. scenes. I think
like
those are the best
scenes. Stoically take them, or in his case, you know, you kind of, you laugh them off when you don't think they're funny.
Right.
Yeah. I thought that was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed very authentic to me in a way. In the same way, I feel like the character of Matt and the way he sometimes kind of walks into humiliation almost like preemptively, or just like the way he speaks up in class, the way he does, the way they make that movie, you know, like,
yeah, you like that.
Well, yes, because it seemed very believable to me.
Really?
I knew people like that.
Really?
Who, yeah.
Oh, that's
who
interesting.
Kind of almost like walked into preemptively did things that would draw would draw ire and attention almost like as a way of getting it over with, or like as a kind of masochistic thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're
oh,
already getting bullied, so why don't you just do the thing that you know is going to to bring it on.
No, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I to me, sometimes those scenes bordered on like absurd, because they were so, the characters seemed so unaware of what they were doing. Like,
yeah.
Well, of course this is going to draw more bullying.
Yeah.
You know, like, because I was a kid who was bullied in high school.
Yeah.
And I was putting myself into these situations going, I wouldn't, like, this is just, you're just asking for trouble. Not that you deserve the trouble, but you're like, you're giving more opportunities to get picked on. But, you know, that's interesting that you feel like it actually did ring true to you. So.
Yeah, it did. It really reminded me of some people I knew. And I was much less happy with the whole media commentary thing. I'm not sure that the film really knew where it was going with that. And I'm not sure I know where it was going with that. You know, we're obviously in a media saturated age.
Yes.
There, and kind of finding solace in, you know, all of these different aspects of pop culture is absolutely a part of I'm sure a lot of people's experiences, formative experiences growing up. But I thought the way the film portrays him as having trouble maybe separating the part, like the movie, from his life, I was not something I cared about or bought.
Yeah.
Really.
I mean, I liked the visual of like that man cave that Matt and Owen have, that where they're like, the walls are covered with comic books and magic cards and DVDs and movie posters. And it almost feels like, you know, the idea of like pop culture as this protective bubble, you know, that they're like literally like swaddled in pop culture. And a lot of bullied kids, like this one right here, definitely did stuff like that. You like lose yourself in that protective bubble of superheroes and you know, movies and all that sort of stuff. But then I don't know that the movie quite justifies he's been like driven to do this because of movies. You know, it really kind of hammers that home just by like sheer repetition of, well, he quotes from movies and, oh, like this is, I'm doing the Joker in The Dark Knight here. It just seemed a little, like you said, it just doesn't, I don't know if it really, the movie kind of makes a good enough case, you know?
I don't know that the movie even really believed that. That was the part.
But
it felt,
there.
I know, but
there.
It felt insincere, you know?
Right,
yeah. What did you think of the references that he uses? There's one part in the very beginning, which I thought was very funny. They're talking to two kids that they run into who are also making their own movie, like younger kids.
Right,
and he mentions Irreversible, which is a really funny reference to throw to two, like, 11-year-old kids or whatever they were.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it is. I think it's there as a joke more than as a authentic reference. I mean, there was a few times where I was like questioning their sort of, as like presumably like 16, 17-year-old kids, like their frame of reference for movies. Like if you look at their, again, that pop culture bubble, that room, which I thought, again, like a really clever and effective metaphor, you look on the wall, there's like a poster for like Wonder Boys and a poster for like Schindler's List. And it's just like, what 16-year-old boy who's so obsessed with violent video games and all this sort of thing would like have Wonder Boys or Schindler's List on his wall? It just seemed, I don't know, the frame of reference
seemed off.
A little off. And again, it to me, it did seem more like a piece with a guy who's like probably our age, a little younger, who's like looking at like his frame of reference from that time.
Yeah,
unless what an actual 16-year-old
these
now
days would have access. I did like the portrayal of their friendship. I thought like it really kind of, until it, you know, sours towards the end. It's a really sweet portrayal of just how two high school guys.
They like, have good chemistry, the two actors, and in general, like I said, the fact that they shot it in a real high school with real kids in the backgrounds definitely adds a heightened element of reality and makes the movie more disturbing. All right, last thing before, I don't want to spoil it, but before we go, the ending. Did you think it ended at the right place? Would you have liked more? What did you think of, without spoiling the details, was the ending effective for you?
I hated the last line.
Mm.
I thought that the way it was before that, as it was playing out, was like frighteningly realistic.
Yes.
I didn't like the very note it ended on. I loved the credits.
The credits are maybe the best part of the movie.
They're fantastic.
And probably the most interesting part of that whole media saturation aspect of the movie is the closing credits. I agree with you there. And the fact that we have kind of seen that introduced in the movie does make them more interesting. And, all right, that's a good place to end it, I think. I think you maybe liked it a little bit more than I did.
Yeah, I think so.
A little
mixed on it. But
it's certainly an interesting film.
And it's a really great first effort.
I was going to say, it's a very impressive first film. It's certainly ambitious. You know, if $10,000 is what they made it for, kudos to them. That's definitely an achievement. And it has some interesting things to say. And we just talked about it for 20 minutes, so it can't be that bad if we're had that much to chew on. It definitely gives you stuff to talk about. That is The Dirties, available on all sorts of platforms and systems. You can rent it pretty much anywhere online, right? iTunes, Amazon.
YouTube, all of them, I think.
All of the main players,
yeah.
You can rent it online. And if you agree with us, you disagree with us. I know we had people suggesting this film to talk about. Curious to hear from them, so email us, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. Tell us what you think about The Dirties.
Now it's time for our Behind the Eight Ball segment, in which we offer you three new films to streaming, two listener recommendations, and one randomly selected item from our My List.
My List.
I knew you couldn't resist. All right,
you stared me down.
Matt, you're up first. You ready?
I'm up next, and I'm up first.
Yes.
Yes, I am ready.
All right, three new picks.
Okay, I'll start with a very interesting and entertaining Spanish movie I saw at this year's Ebert Fest. It's called Blanca Nieves. It's a 2012 film that retells the fairy tale of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves as a black and white silent film. With some very unique twists. The dwarves aren't miners in this one, Allison. They're bullfighters.
Ooh.
They're
indeed. Twist, indeed.
The seven bullfighting dwarves. And Snow White gets into the bullfighting as well herself. It's a beautifully shot movie. It's dark. It's funny. It's very whimsical. It really does feel like kind of an old school, you know, Grimm's fairy tale where it's dark. It's not just, you know, this is not Disney's Snow White. Let's put it that way. And if you're a fan of animal performances in films, Pepe the Rooster gives a really outstanding Oscar-worthy performance in Blanca Nieves. So, you know, I'm sure if you hear this, you go, oh, it must be like The Artist or something because it's a new film that's a silent film, black and white. But it's a little different. And also, I think it doesn't cheat in the way The Artist did at times with the score and with some of the dialogue and sound effects. So it's an interesting little film. Blanca Nieves, available now on Netflix. Next up, for a throwback of a different kind, check out The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, which is also available now on Netflix. It's a wonderfully weird cult oddity from the 1980s. It's sort of a cross between... It's a little bit like an adventure serial from the 1930s. It's kind of like an old great comic book that was never published. And there's a little bit of a Monty Python sketch in here, too, I think. Peter Weller stars as Buckaroo Banzai, who's an adventurer, a crime fighter, a neurosurgeon, and a rock star. That old cliche, who, along with his group, the Hong Kong Cavaliers, are fighting an invasion of the evil red Lectroid aliens. And the aliens are played by Dan Hedaya, Vincent Chiavelli, John Lithgow as Dr. Emilio Lizardo, and Christopher Lloyd as, Allison, do you know his name? John Big Booty, or, excuse me, Big Booty! That's like enough crazy character actors for 100 movies, and they're all in this movie together. I recently rewatched this one to participate in a staff forum at the Dissolve, the website I worked for, where this was one of our movies of the week. And it was a lot of fun. You know, the really fun part of it is so many superhero movies these days, Allison, but they're all like, especially the first one, it's always an origin story. And it's that same tired rehash of the same story we've made a million times. Buckaroo Banzai is treated like it's issue number 155 of The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. There's all these references to other existing adventures and stories that we have no idea what they mean, but they're sort of as a winking in-joke to the fact that this is the first adventure for us, but this is Buckaroo Banzai does this every day, so this is just the latest adventure. And I really love that sort of the spirit of dense continuity that we don't understand is really unusual and a lot of fun. It's a really great cult movie. So that's The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. And it's available on Netflix. And finally, available on Amazon Prime, the brilliant Star Trek parody Galaxy Quest from director Dean Parisot. The film is about the actors of a once popular, now canceled television series called Galaxy Quest, which is basically Star Trek. And they are mistaken for actual spacefaring heroes by the members of a not particularly bright alien race. They call on them to save them from another alien race that wants to destroy them. If you've never seen the film, which stars Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman, Tony Shalhoub, and in two of their early screen performances, Justin Long and Sam Rockwell, who's really great as is it Guy Fliegman, I think is his name. It's just a really great satire of Star Trek and Star Trek fandom, and it's a pretty satisfying adventure film as well. I haven't seen this movie in a while. I actually, looking at it, popping up on Amazon, I was going, I got to rewatch it. It's been too long since I've seen Galaxy Quest, which again is available now on Amazon Prime.
Okay, two listener recommendations.
All right, we've got a bunch here. I'm going to give you two, and then I'm going to give a quick shout-out to a third because I want to get as many in here as we can. This first one is from, apparently, the director, James Cameron, wrote into us, Allison. Or maybe it's just someone else with the name James Cameron who's a listener.
And who's never heard that joke before.
Never. Never. Never possible. Anyway, James writes, "Hey, Sfuvians. I watched a film that this weekend that pleasantly surprised me, so I thought I would recommend it in case anyone else was put off by the lackluster romantic comedy marketing, or more likely had never heard of it. The film is I Give It a Year, about a pair of newlyweds dealing with the petty annoyances and comedic misunderstandings that come with being married, as well as fending off the attentions of the smarmy mentalist and a dowdy Anna Faris, also featuring Stephen Merchant, essentially playing himself with all the best lines. It manages to be laugh-out-loud funny, but also somewhat true to life." And James says, "Full disclosure, I am an Englishman, and I'm not sure if it's available over in the United States, but you can watch it on Love Film here," Love Film being a UK streaming service. "If you want to give it some transatlantic attention, I very much enjoy your show. As a parent, actual visits to the cinema are rare, but nights on the sofa are plentiful, so your recommendations are taken up regularly here. Thanks." That's from the director of Avatar, James Cameron, recommending I Give It a Year. I'm not sure if it's streaming anywhere, but I'm sure it's available somewhere to rent. Thank you, James, for that recommendation. I've also got a recommendation here from Martin, who gave me his Twitter handle, which I'm happy to share Twitter handles. If people want to include their Twitter handles on the show, we can give him shout-outs. If you want to follow Martin, he's at JohnCastMart, JawnCastMart. Martin says, "I recommend A Horrible Way to Die. A lot of movies involving serial killers end up pretentious messes that are nowhere near as clever as they think they are. Not so here, as Simon Barrett and Adam Wingard, writer and director of the well-received You Are Next, and also contributors to VHS 2, which I talked about earlier, crafted a superb thriller here. A Horrible Way to Die effortlessly shifts between the escape of a serial killer, the ex-girlfriend of said killer trying to move on with her life, and flashbacks to the relationship between the two with such aplomb, I was utterly enthralled for its whole running time. Love the show. Keep up the good work." That was Martin. And very quickly, we also got a lovely bunch of recommendations from Crystal, who recommends Broadcast News, now available on Netflix, Ronin, now available on Netflix, and The Devil's Backbone, now available on Crackle.
All right, and one from your My List.
You gave me number 111, which is Abduction, starring the finest actor of his or any generation, Taylor Lautner, as a young man who finds his picture on a missing person's website and begins to question everything he knows. Questions like, am I really an actor? Will my career continue past the Twilight franchise? So many questions, Allison. My big question is, why did John Singleton direct this?
I'm glad you brought that up.
Why are Sigourney Weaver, Maria Bello, Jason Isaacs, and Alfred Molina all also in this? Why did I add this to my list? I don't know.
I've already seen this one.
Oh my God, is it good? Is it as good as I thought it would be?
It...
True or false, Allison, there is no actual abduction in the movie.
There is no abduction.
No, why would there
Absolutely
be?
Absolutely not. No. The actual explanation is much worse.
Really?
Of just like ridiculous, yes.
But, do I need to watch it? It seems like it
yes,
could be really hilarious.
I think you absolutely should watch it. It does, like, poor Taylor Lautner is just not ready, anywhere near ready to lead a movie.
And who's the least embarrassed to be in this movie? Sigourney Weaver, Maria Bello, Jason Isaacs, or Alfred Molina? Who's the best in the
I'm
movie?
I'm just going to give it to Molina.
Why not?
I feel like he does some kind of...
Does he have a beard?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
Oh.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Too bad.
Sorry.
All right. Well, that's Abduction, and God help me, it is available now on Netflix. Allison, are you ready for your Behind the Eight Ball segment?
I am.
Let's start with three new releases.
All right. First up is a film that is new to Netflix, and I was really happy to see on there. It is This Is Not a Film, which is from Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi and Motaba Mirtamaz. And I'm sorry if that's nowhere near how it is actually pronounced.
We're slaughtering so many names on this episode.
But it's a film that is shot surreptitiously while Panahi was under house arrest in Iran. He's been banned from making films. The film was famously smuggled to Cannes in a cake. on a flash drive and is filmed in part on an iPhone. And it is so difficult to describe, as the title might suggest. It is a doc, but it's also kind of a hybrid. They fudge some things, but it's mostly filmed while Panahi is at home in his apartment almost entirely. He's not allowed to leave the grounds of the building, but he walks us through, his friend through, the film that he was working on. And coincidentally, it is about a girl who is locked up by her family for wanting to attend college. And it manages to be both this really kind of funny commentary on films and why we need films as opposed to just storytelling. It's an incredible statement on being silenced, and it's also just incredibly unexpectedly sad at the end. It's great. It was one of both of our favorites.
Amazing movie.
Yeah, 2012.
You haven't seen it.
It's fantastic.
My list.
Yes, please. Now, my next pick is on Hulu, and it is called Thesis. It's a 1996 film. Speaking of like other meta films, it is the debut from the Spanish-Chilean filmmaker Alejandro Amenábar, who directed Open Your Eyes, The Others, and The Sea Inside.
Mm.
This is a lower-budget thriller about a film student who is writing her thesis on violence on screen and is friends with a classmate who is a huge horror fan. And they both get pulled into this mystery involving an apparent snuff film featuring another student they know on campus. So it's a thriller. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember it being, both managing to be a thriller and have some of that commentary on watching, right? Like on the process of watching violence on screen and why we do it. That's Thesis. It's on Hulu. And my last pick is available on Crackle, and it is Crawl. That's Peter Yates' 1983 film, set on the planet Crawl, about a prince looking to rescue his kidnapped princess bride from the Beast, who arrived in his fortress spaceship, which transports around the planet every day.
You're a Crawl fan, Allison?
Yeah, I have a soft spot for it.
Really?
I feel like this is not a film I saw like growing up. It was one that I came to later.
It's getting more and more inexplicable by the second.
No, but I feel like there's something about, like, this was a really expensive film at the time, right? And there's something about practical effects and like even ones that don't necessarily hold up very well in this case.
No.
They overreach incredibly, but in a really like kind of hearteningly dedicated way. There's something about Ken Marshall's face as Colwyn as he tries to control the glaive, which is the name for
you, are a hardcore Crawl fan.
Five-pointed knife boomerang that he uses. That is, I find hilarious and yet like kind of touching. It has to be controlled with your willpower. And so his like acting face as he's trying to be like, I'm going to move the glaive with my mind, I find incredibly entertaining. And, I feel like there's automatic nostalgia, even if it's not from, childhood experiences, with seeing a lot of slightly shabby looking practical effects. And this one has plenty. It has so many. It's an extravaganza of slightly shabby looking practical effects. And also features a young Liam Neeson in
right.
an early role.
That's right.
As his career went from kind of silliness to great seriousness and back to silliness again, where we are right now.
Thank goodness.
So that is
all worked out.
Yes, that is Crawl. It is available on Crackle.
Going to bat for Crawl.
Absolutely.
Love it. I love it. I love that Peter Yates, the late great Peter Yates, who made some of my favorite like hardcore crime movies of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Bullet, The Hot Rock, it's Friends like, of Eddie Coyle, super gritty.
Totally. And he's like, you know what the world
Crawl.
Really needs?
Next up
is
Crawl.
A fantasy science fiction hybrid.
Five-sided ninja star thingy.
Woo! Yep.
All right. Great picks. All right. How about two listener recommendations?
All right. The first one is from Paco, who says, I'm writing in to recommend Chris Marker's La Jetée, which is streaming with Hulu Plus or available for rent on Amazon and iTunes. It's a film many have heard of, but few have watched. Gilliam's 12 Monkeys is famously an adaptation of this very unique film, which is shot completely using stills and voiceover. Despite these limitations, the narrative is engaging and really had me thinking of the versatility of the medium and what films could have been made better if approached from this perspective. Anyways, it has science fiction elements, time travel, and is only about half an hour long. It's from the 1960s in black and white and French. Watch it and be the cool guy at the next theme potluck you visit. Which is who can resist that?
Sold!
Yes. And, it is. La Jetée, if you haven't seen it, it is half an hour. It is exquisite. Like, it's just gorgeous. It is very much worth seeking out. And the second listener recommendation is from Matthew, who says, "Hi, guys. I know I'm a little late to the party with a screaming recommendation. But I just watched this film, and A, it seems very much in line with your guys' taste, and B, it's got an element of body horror to it, which I know both horrifies and intrigues Allison," which is absolutely true. The film is American Mary from 2012, directed by the Canadian filmmaking duo of the Suska sisters, the twins who previously made Dead Hooker in a Trunk, which is a... it's one of those titles that, you know, you got to make the film. Mary stars Catherine Isabel as a med student who begins performing illegal body modification surgery as a way of making ends meet, and hilarity ensues from there. The film is very dark and at times very disturbing, but it's also permeated with a wicked sense of humor, has a lot of interesting things to say about the way women are perceived and treated in modern society based on their looks. So that's American Mary, and it is currently streaming on Netflix.
Okay, and one random film from your queue, and I hope it's half as good as Abduction.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Oh, did I say queue? I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
One random film from my list.
Thank you. You gave me number 91, and that is Walker, which is the 1987 film from Alex Cox, starring Ed Harris as Soldier of Fortune William Walker, who in the 1950s, with the help of mercenaries, overthrows the Nicaraguan government and takes over the presidency himself. It's kind of a famously anachronistic, deliberately anachronistic film that's about American imperialism and features a score by Joe Strummer. So it's one that, and I think is one that usually people say is either, you know, misunderstood great or this, you know, famous overreaching flop. So,
and Taylor Lautner plays who in that one?
I think he plays all the other characters.
Nice.
It's a masterful role. He wasn't even born yet, I think.
Does like the Eddie Murphy and the Nutty Professor thing.
I think in 1987 he was not yet born, so it's really amazing, particularly amazing for that.
A work of fetal greatness by Taylor Lautner in Walker. All right. Well, this is the part of the show where we normally run down our three options for our next listener's choice review, but we don't have to do that this time because we had a contest on our last episode where we asked you to submit a review on iTunes, and everyone who gave us a review, regardless of the grade, would be entered, and we would just randomly pick one person, and that one person would get to pick the next listener's choice review. It would be their one listener's choice. Instead of the will of the mob, it would be the will of one. And so that is what we did. We want to thank everyone for entering. We got a lot of great reviews on iTunes. We got a couple not so good reviews. Some people don't like me.
That's a little wounded.
Some people don't like me, apparently. You know, my funny voices. I don't know what it is. People don't have a funny voice. I don't get it. I feel like I have a very normal voice. People don't like my voice. I was told I sound like a 14-year-old on Ritalin. I've never even taken Ritalin. Maybe I should. Would it help, Allison?
I have no opinion.
Oh,
well,
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry, Matt.
We did get a lot of, but we did get a lot of positive reviews. Because I had to do this and get all the names, I did read all of the reviews. We appreciated all of them. There were some very nice comments, some really funny ones. Someone described us as a married couple, even though they know we're not married, but that was how they envision us when they play with their dolls. I thought that was really. I wish that person could have won. Unfortunately, it was a random drawing. If I had gotten to choose,
just from rating those comments,
yeah, just from rating the ratings, that would have been the winner. But we did pick it random. I did put all the negative reviews in there. It could have been one of the people that hated me, which would have been fascinating.
Very interesting.
To see what they would have chosen, but it wasn't. That wasn't the winner. The winner was the person whose Apple ID was Sturgidson. Sturgidson, Sturgidson. So congratulations. Email us, SVU at filmspottingsvu.com with your pick. Remember, we got to do, it's got to be something that's available to stream on Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon, or we can rent it on iTunes or Amazon. Somewhere we can get it. Don't pick something that's out of print. You know, Cannibal Holocaust, we can't do it. We can't find it. You know, so something that we can find to rent or stream somewhere legally. Beyond that, the world is your oyster, Sturgidson. You have the power, but use it well. Use it well.
So as soon as we hear from our lucky winner and the film that he or she has chosen, we will announce it on our Twitter account, which is at twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you will have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on the next episode, which will be on Tuesday, November 19th.
You can also check out Filmspotting SVU for our show archive, as well as a list to direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review that Sturgidson picks. In the meantime, you can follow me and Allison on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And again, you can follow the show at FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of every show's listener's choice, and in this case, the one listener's choice. And we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. We also announce the theme of our Q Shots, where we love to hear from you guys. Send your feedback, SVU@FilmSpottingSVU.com. 8-ball recommendations, Q Shot recommendations. We love to hear from you. Send us your feedback. SVU@FilmSpottingSVU.com. And for Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.